with AI or running like, you know, phishing or ATO campaigns have scaled up pretty rapidly in the last 18 months. It's almost impossible to trust a source of an image or video thanks to Gen AI. And it also improved a lot in the last 12 months. So if you look at an image of a document, or if you look at a video of someone, right? Like, you cannot tell whether if it's real or not.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast, where we talk to the people who keep the internet safe. These industry experts share their innovative cyber defense technologies, vital insights into threats, and predictions for the future of cybersecurity. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. This podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud platform, infrastructure for SecOps where everything is built API first. Scale with confidence as your business grows. Start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. My guest today is Tomas Karar, co-founder and CEO of Cion, a global fraud prevention company helping businesses detect and stop online fraud before it happens. After co-founding a cryptocurrency exchange and experiencing the challenges of fraud firsthand, Tomas launched Cion in 2017 with a mission to make enterprise-grade fraud prevention more accessible, transparent, and effective. Under his leadership, the company has grown to serve thousands of businesses worldwide and become a trusted partner across fintech, e-commerce, gaming, and financial services. In this conversation, we'll discuss Tomas's entrepreneurial journey from Hungary to building a fast-growing global software company, the evolving fraud landscape in the age of AI, and why he believes fraud prevention should be viewed as a growth driver rather than a cost center. We'll also explore lessons from scaling Cion internationally, navigating competitive markets, and staying ahead of the increasingly sophisticated digital threats today. Thank you so much for being on the show with us today, Tomas. It's a real honor to have you here.
Christopher, thank you so much for having me, and pleasure to be here.
I usually like to start things off asking people how they initially got interested in technology. And I read a little bit about how you sold some modified smartphones as a teenager in Hungary. So let's maybe start with your first computer experience and how we landed at smartphones in Hungary.
Yeah, you know, when I was about 3 or 4 years old, so in the 90s, we were the first one in our district in Budapest who had internet. So my father was an electrical engineer, and he got me interested, excited about computers. And it's at a very early age. So as soon as we got like real ADSL connection, you know, my bandwidth, both for internet and my brain, has expanded. So I could consume way more information that with just like the normal modem type of connection. But yeah, it was, yeah, thanks to my parents. You know, I was interested in how just internet is not just connecting people, but also is usable later on to send payments. And also that has led into the interest, you know, of, it wasn't really called fintech, but like financial services or the internet, really. Mm-hmm. So I remember I had my first PayPal account when I was like 12. So it was super exciting for me. And then, crypto was another kind of influence on how myself and my co-founder was thinking. But it goes back, over 30 years ago now.
And so, but your first entrepreneurial adventure was selling modified smartphones. What did that look like?
Yeah, it was a side job, in high school. So first, what I found out, this is like 2008 when iPhone came out. And since I am from Eastern Europe, not many people had phones for an iPhone, and people wanted to have a touch screen phone. Like, that was like new. Not everyone spoke English right where I'm from. So I just found a gap in the market, and many Asian sellers were trying to enter the market, but they had no distribution centers or efforts in a region. So I just realized, like, first I've ordered a couple of these phones from Alibaba, and the interest was not high because everyone was asking me like, hey, can they support, local language, Hungary? And I said like, well, not really like they all have like just English and German and some of like main languages as the default option. So I was really digging deep into, you know, what kind of firmwares these phones are running on, how I can download, upload the firmware. I found out that there were some companies who were selling these, you know, firmware changer boxes, like you could connect to the ports, or in some cases you had to like disassemble the phone and solder the wires into the ports on the phone in order to like download and upload the firmware. And that was useful, but also like, you know, in order to read the firmware, I had to dig even deeper, and I found an online forum where people are discussing different approaches, and someone made like a sort of like a prototype which could actually classify different languages, have a translation option, basically just a dictionary of the words of the phone for each of the, you know, buttons that you can click on. So I sort of like, you know, hacked that software and improved on it, and I made it like universal. So when I was restarting these phones after adding local language Hungarian, and also I was offering this service to random people if they had issues with their own phones, and I, you know, brought it to my home. Obviously I was living with my parents when I was 15, but you know, I learned a lot during this first couple of years, and that helped me to be interested in doing my own thing later on. And and you know, this like entirely different space, but you know, working with customers and, you know, seeing how e-commerce works and how you can send money. Like the first time I was sending the funds to overseas, like that was like, you know, an eye-opening moment for me, like how limited technologies were, and you know, how the reimbursement and kind of dispute options were also like sort of limited, but also were opening some, you know, loopholes in those transactions. So anyway, like that was like my first entrepreneurial experience back then, you know, over 16 years ago.
Oh, that's super fun. It kind of reminds me of Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak selling blue boxes, you know, like a later version of that kind of thing. So super cool. I imagine that would have been an exciting thing to do as a teenager. And then you obviously went on, you grew your career in technology. And before Sion, you co-founded a cryptocurrency exchange. So I'm guessing probably around 2010, maybe a little later. What was happening in the market then, and what made you interested in that?
Yeah, I've met my co-founder at university back in 2013. And we both knew about Bitcoin already at that time. But it was, you know, only used on weird places like Silk Road and Darknet marketplaces. So essentially, I wouldn't say we have co-founded a crypto exchange. We tried to launch a crypto exchange.
I see.
And what we saw is that every other crypto exchange was pushing customers through this frictionful KYC process. You know, they were forcing you to upload your, you know, identity document, your passport. And also the only payment method that they have accepted was bank transfers, which took 3 to 5 days, right? So our initial thesis was, why don't we just, you know, create a landing page and then put a checkout button on it? And turns out it wasn't a great idea. And the reason why is because crypto and, you know, Bitcoin, of course, is sort of like the primary target for fraudsters, because it's essentially digital cash, right? So when they cash out from the operation, that's what they're after. You know, they can also tumble and you know, hide the traces of crypto. So if they are sophisticated fraudsters, in the end, the kind of, you know, payment that or the currency they're after is crypto. So we have learned the hard way just within the first week of, you know, losing half of our transaction volume due to chargebacks, and we haven't heard about, you know, online fraud or chargebacks, or really haven't invested too much time in cybercrime. But this was like a brand new chapter in our lives, and we just spent the entire summer afterwards learning and, you know, trying to soak up all the information we could find on any place on the internet about, you know, how fraudsters are operating, what kind of tools, methods they use, what kind of softwares they could get access to, what are their primary targets. And then we found out that, you know, actually the big players, the big vendors out there wouldn't even cater to such an early stage business like ours. So, you know, they were trying to disqualify us because, you know, our website didn't seem too serious for them, right? And one of these businesses were actually offering like a self-serve product-led motion, such as like a Stripe, you know, or Twilio did it back, you know, like 15 years ago. And also, when we could actually get access to some, you know, real presentations or product demos, they were lacking some of the features that we would think that could have been instrumental to assess risk of those customers in a completely friction-free, invisible manner.
So this experience with fraud is what eventually inspired you to start Sion. Can we talk about what the founding of that looked like and what your core mission is, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, of course. You know, what we have realized is basically the crypto exchange could have been a great business, but since we have, you know, kind of we could reveal this gap of the market of not having really like a solution which takes into consideration for a risk assessment process such, you know, straightforward data points like someone's email address, phone number, or your device they are using, we have decided to, you know, pivot into launching Sion in 2017. The mission and the vision hasn't changed since then. Like, making the internet a safer place to do business is what we try to, you know, help everyone out there with. In terms of like, you know, how the product and, you know, the company and of course, you know, our GTM motions and entire team has evolved, has been drastic, right? So we didn't know that back then, you know, just coming out of university, you had no working, like real working experience. You know, it has been a steep learning curve for both myself and my co-founder, but we got started in 2017 just by raising 50,000 euros, you know, which was enough for about 10 months. And we could only hire my brother, who was back then working for HSBC as an engineer. And now he switched, you know, over to us. And then we hired another engineer from university. So like four university, you know, guys, students, or almost like, you know, like post-grad, like fresh post-grad folks.
Yeah. A lot of energy.
A lot of energy, not much knowledge or skills or experience. But, you know, I think at least we've gained something over the last, you know, 8 to 9 years. But yeah, first 2.5 years was about finding product market fit and like taking the business to 1 million ARR. And this was just before COVID, right? So we knew that there's a lot of manual operation, you know, in kind of the manual investigation of finding out whether someone is using a stolen identity or, you know, creating a synthetic identity or using a stolen payment instrument like a stolen credit card number. And what was super interesting for us is, you know, the first couple of months going to the offices of these fraud teams and seeing what they do, you know, in multiple shifts, right? So one of these places where KLM, the airline company, right? And they had a team in Budapest, you know, over 20 people working in 3 shifts. And they were copy-pasting email addresses, phone numbers, IP addresses to, you know, 20 plus taps in their browser to find more intelligence. And it took, you know, more than 50 minutes to just make a simple assessment, a simple classification of whether they should accept or not that specific, you know, booking. And we thought that, hey, you know, why don't we like automate all of it? Like, you know, it's possible to collect all this data if we, and real time, of course, if we centralize all these data sources into one API and then offer that as a service to our business to our potential clients. So we started out by just, you know, drafting and building this prototype of a single API without a UI even. So we found, you know, payment gateway, a couple of clients, and you know, we really started to do a lot of outbound to see like, okay, which industry, which market could find the most value in this solution, because we didn't know. Like we haven't really worked with anyone in this space, you know, we're completely outsiders, also young. So we just had to realize that there are certain markets where, you know, risk related issues, challenges, and also compliance is just across the board. Like those businesses are operating sort of like a digital wallet. When you can board online, you can deposit money, you know, withdraw money. Essentially, you're like a digital wallet. Like this could be like digital banks, fintech businesses, iGaming operators. And these operators, these merchants, were always looking for, you know, the newest tools. They were always willing to invest in trialing and seeing the value. So our approach was like, hey, you know, we're working on something cool. Do you want to give it a go? You know, so that helped us to, you know, find or core ICPs. As eventually, you know, this space is fintech and iGaming has become and also remained our core ICPs, and still it is today. So the mission and kind of the value proposition hasn't changed. Of course, the product has evolved and as the company. But we are still trying to solve the same challenges, of course, way more accurately now with more signals, more intel, you know, and also, you know, with new products in complementary places like compliance, for example. But we just have seen that even though all these businesses were still doing normal KYC, so they were asking, in most cases, for like a document, and maybe by doing like a SAF license, you know, fraud was still bypassing these measures, right? It was not bulletproof. It was also expensive and frictionful in an onboarding process. So they have taken our solution to make it more bulletproof, right? To actually have a firewall on your application before your customers can be onboarded or even get to the stage of, you know, doing proper KYC on them. Because what would you pay a dollar for an onboarding check when you can pay just a couple of cents and like filter out those customers who might not be even worthwhile to take to the real onboarding stage, right? So that's what we call like pre-KYC today. And that's what we got really strong at. And that's has become our moat and kind of USP over the years.
Very interesting. And yeah, you know, getting to 1 million ARR in just a couple of years, I think that's very impressive. You've talked about having to reinvent the company around the 10 million ARR mark. What was that about and what drove that decision?
Yeah, I would say like we had to reinvent at like the 1 million ARR mark because back then we had no sales team, no GTM experience. So it was like me and my co-founder like doing a bunch of outbound investing.
Cold calls,
cold LinkedIn messages, investing a lot in SEO, and organic growth was also helpful since the very beginning. So we have doubled down on kind of the content strategy, you know, to be discoverable, to be seen. So when we go to the 1 million ARR mark, I just knew that, hey, we have to have like some sort of like real salespeople in the team. Like we couldn't take all the inbound calls. And then, you know, this was actually during COVID. So we scaled up from 1 to 10 in 2 years during COVID.
Oh, wow.
And we've built like a large team and we've raised a ton of money. But also we're primarily playing in Europe, right? And also mostly still at the onboarding stage with one main product, right? So at 10 million, we just realized that, hey, the largest software market is in the States, right? And we didn't really have competitors in Europe anymore. Like we had the early mover advantage in Europe, which we could, you know, capture on. And, you know, during COVID, like offline events and kind of the buyer and discovery journey has changed. So it was pretty helpful for us to have doubled down on that, like, you know, kind of like, you know, inbound channels too. And you know, investing in product-led growth and you know, putting the product in the front and center and offering like self-serve options. But also we have realized that, you know, real big buyers, enterprise clients have to hold their hands throughout the onboarding stage. And you know, at that time, we had 10 million ARR, you know, 80% of our traffic was coming from onboarding, plus more than half of our clients were buying the signals and not the decisions from us, right? So it wasn't sticky enough to the extent of being irreplaceable, right? So at 10 million ARR, we just thought that, hey, we have to play in the US, like if we want to go against the big competitors who obviously were, you know, way bigger, much better funded than we were. But of course, they were like, you know, capturing the market opportunity instead of us, right? So we said, hey, let's go to the States. Let's build a real enterprise sales motion. So first, my co-founder has, you know, relocated to Austin, where we set up shop in the States. And I followed him after 18 months. And we've hired a very talented, CRO who has built certain functions of the team we have never thought of that we might need, such as, an onboarding CS function or, a social engineering team or, account manager team. So we have built up all those functions, built like a real playbook, double down on the US market. We had to learn a lot about the differences of the US versus European payment rails. Like they're similar, but also quite different. Especially I would say like Europe seems to be more mature, right? On the fintech side, mm-hmm. there are more players, more like this kind of digital wallet operators, but still, even though in the US there are few, but they're much larger, right? They're capturing a much larger portion of the market. So at 10 million, we did all those changes. We had to focus on even back then in 2022, we have sort of like re-engineered the entire company strategy and said that, hey, we need to have like three horizons. Like first, operationally being excellent, right? Like, hey, getting more out of what we have, using the funds that we have raised the wisest way possible was critical because we didn't know when we can go out and raise funds again. You're just entering the crypto and fintech winter mid-2022 has affected most businesses, most SaaS businesses as well. Like now the AI evolution is also affecting businesses. So we're going through sort of another reinvention now, at 100 million euro mark. So I think these are like all evolutionary steps, but there are certain metrics of horizons. Like horizon one was being operationally excellent. Horizon two was being of a system of a record, which means that Sion is not only focused in on providing the highest quality first party signals, which is our moat and was even back then, but also how we can have the most accurate decisions, how we can cover the entire customer journey, not just registrations, but logins, because fraud is very fluid. So businesses are seeing challenges today more so around like account takeover attacks, mm-hmm. scams, hacks, and so on, versus just onboarding fraud, right? Like and back then it was mainly about onboarding. Payment challenges, chargebacks, again, sort of like different, but similar data points, but different assessment method, different algorithm. So we had to in terms of being a system of record, we had to be, good at the signals because as a company, you can only make as good decisions as the data you have access to. But then the algorithm was critical and also the approach of, hey, opening up for compliance because we knew that, hey, most of these businesses are also, facing challenges with anti-money laundering. And the data sources are similar, first, last name, date of birth. So we've acquired a business 3 years, almost 4 years ago now for EMS screening. And then we have started to invest in our own KYC product in the last 2 years because we knew that, hey, in our core ICP's wallet share, Sion only owns like a small part. Like in order for us to climb up in the wallet share, we actually have to, own the entire chain. So that's why mm-hmm. we started to invest in KYC ourselves 2 years ago. Now it's a live product and we have built onto the strengths of the platform we have. And the last horizon three was AI, right? Even back in 2022, before ChatGPT came out, we thought that, machine learning is great and it's, fraud detection is the primary use case for machine learning. But also, your algorithm is only as good as your training model, which means that the more signals you have, the better labels you have on your data, the better models you can build. But to keep it, transparent, white box was super important because we saw that the big players who were more sort of like black box and the end users couldn't really influence the decisioning algorithm. It couldn't really overwrite or set up the right guardrails around the policies they want to implement was also a challenge for all the businesses out there. So we took the route of like implementing a machine learning model which keeps the decisioning and keeps the algorithm supervisable by humans in the end, right? So those horizons and the strategy hasn't changed. Now with AI, we are just getting smarter of, hey, what really like, you know, LLMs can help with. And they can have a ton of stuff. I think a lot of businesses are just, you know, kind of AI washing their own proposal to the market by placing LLMs in certain places, which might help with, you know, the workflows and the processes for their end users. But it then doesn't really make a huge impact on how quickly they can make changes to the algorithm for real-time assessment. We don't see much of that today, but it might change with agentic workflows. We're also trying to like stay on the front lines of that evolution right now.
Hey, it's Nicole from the Lima Charlie marketing team. Many security teams deal with tool sprawl, dozens of different solutions that create gaps in visibility and slow down response times. Our SecOps Cloud platform consolidates your security stack into a unified platform where everything works together. Lima Charlie gives you comprehensive endpoint visibility and automated response capabilities in milliseconds instead of minutes, so you can stop threats before they spread across your environment. Try our scalable infrastructure for your security services for free at limacharlie.io.
I'm curious, you know, talking about AI and fraud prevention, obviously on your side, you're using machine learning to do anomaly detection and things like that. From the attacker side, how have things evolved? Like, is it, are fraud prevention companies falling behind right now? How is that going?
I think there's definitely, like, fraud is ever growing, right? So we don't see that it's slowing down to an extent. Well, with AI, it has just even accelerated more. You can easily, if you were a fraudster, you can easily set up certain operations without knowing how to code today with AI, which was sort of impossible even 2 years ago, right? So how people are, forming accounts, generating synthetic identities with AI, or running like, you know, phishing or ATO campaigns have scaled up pretty rapidly in the last 18 months. It's almost impossible to trust a source of an image or video thanks to Gen AI. It has also improved a lot in the last 12 months. So if you look at an image of a document, or if you look at a video of someone, right? Like, you cannot tell whether if it's real or not. It's just not possible anymore. So what we have built, and the reason why I think we got so successful, is because we were not looking at things that are visible for a long time, right? Like things that, the signals that can come from someone's device or email or phone, it's really hard to replicate and recreate someone, you know, digital footprint in terms of like how long this email just has been around on the internet. With these AI-generated synthetic identities, that's the hard part to solve, like, you know, actually reuse real emails with, you know, 10 plus years of history is impossible.
Account takeover kind of thing, right?
Yeah, that's for new accounts, but for account takeover, it's, yeah, like, you know, with account takeovers, you have, you know, limited data points. You can look at device behavior, IP address. You can be smart about, you know, your step of verification flows. Related to ATOs and login, related, you know, threat detection, the data points are more limited, but also there is a big need for, you know, the best customer experience. You don't want to lock out your clients. You don't want to let in the bad guys. But also, you don't want to spend, you know, a ton of money on 2FA and step verifications. You don't want to send like SMSs for every login attempt, you know, especially if you have to log out your clients at some point from their account. Like, you have to be smart about, like, you know, how often you want to force and push them through of like a 2FA or MFA motion. And even though, like, you know, there are, you know, authentication solutions and you know, kind of non-SMS based verification methods, like, the conversion is not great, as we hear from our clients. So they want to be really smart about, you know, having this complete view of the customer journey and really be smart about, you know, when they have to like push through someone a step of verification, when they really have to implement friction in their customer journey That hasn't been like resolved by most of the companies out there. Like I do remember, like even you know 8-9 years ago when some of our early clients brought up you know account takeovers, I just said like, hey, why don't you check for breached passwords? You know, like 99% of you know account takeover attempts are happening due to breached passwords, right? And you know now like you know Chrome and GitHub, they all like alert the clients, but it's only like, you know, single digit of businesses I have ever worked with that are capable of letting their clients know that they're using a password which has been breached like, you know, mm-hmm. many times, and the password might be out there too. So yeah, I think that's you know causing some issues for some businesses out there too.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I never thought about the costs associated with running people through verification steps. Like there's the risk of losing customers because they just don't like to do extra steps, but there's also probably a hard cost as far as the infrastructure that's needed to do that stuff at scale. That's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so you've spoken about connecting signals across fraud, compliance, payments, and product teams. Is this why, like, to gain this holistic view? Is that, what's your reasoning behind that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, historically, many businesses have only thought about fraud as like a payment challenge. You know, it's only due to chargebacks. That's not true because those customers have been onboarded. Like, unless you're like, you know, one-click checkout e-commerce business, then yeah, you might be only facing challenges related to like, you know, chargebacks. But your customers are onboarding on your site. They are doing certain activities after being logged in. They might come back at some point. They might, you know, put some items in the basket or do some activities on your app. But then, you know, they might come back, re-log in. They might, you know, create accounts to resell them to other people. They might, you know, farm accounts to create some history, right? And I think many fraud solutions are working today in silos. So they only look at the payment side. They don't really see, okay, when this customer has been onboarded, like, you know, what kind of data points could have been captured at that stage, and then what happened in between the onboarding and, you know, a financial transaction. That's key too, right? The more data you have, but you have to have all the right data to make the best possible decision at the right time, is crucial and key for the right outcomes. So, you know, even today, like if I look into like, you know, how our traffic is split, right? So it's kind of evenly split between these steps of our client's customer's journey, right? It's an onboarding, it's a login, it's a payment. When the losses occur, might be a payment, but also like you might be better off being proactive of setting up your defenses at early in the customer journey and not even letting those customers to the payment step if they are truly suspicious and showcasing some you know anomalies early on, right? So some businesses are only focused on just, you know, onboarding, right? They do like, hey, we are offering the best KYC solution. Turns out that also, like, you know, cannot be true because, you know, bypassing KYC is not that hard because it's all visible, right? And I said with Gen AI, you can create so convincing deepfake videos, so convincing synthetic IDs that you can try as a fraudster as long as you get through. And when you get through, you are in, right? Like, you know, it's all yours. So some businesses are like, you know, kind of building solutions or like using solutions for filling these gaps. And they think about isolated problem sources, like, you know, having the best conversion and most accurate detection solution onboarding, and then something else for payment, something else for login, something else for DDoS and bot detection. Like in the end, they might end up using like 8-9 vendors which don't communicate with each other, right? And they might be using the same data source. They might be you know, blocking customers based on completely different algorithms, overlapping with the data source. But then, you know, this might disrupt the customer experience. You know, like if one of these solutions might have, you know, a drift in their algorithm, this have like a domino effect and a trickle down effect as well later on in the customer journey. And in the end, it ends up like, you know, being a customer ticket, support tickets, right? And if that team don't have a place to go to and investigate hey, what happened with this customer? If they have to go to 6-7 different systems to look at onboarding data, look at login data, look at, you know, the bot detection, look at the payment fraud detection data, then they will spend 10 times more resources on finding out what went wrong, why we made this decision, you know, and how we can, you know, stop this ripple effect of bad actions, which has impacted then the customers, right? So these teams usually like have, you know, hard time to understand, especially like a CS team, like they might not be experts of fraud, you know, productive mm-hmm. as well. So that's how I think about it. Like if these teams can work off from the same system of a record, if they have a 360-degree view of every touch point with the customer, and then, you know, have these teams to understand and make decisions based on insights and data and look at the customer view throughout all these steps from a centralized point of view, I think it's essential to make the right, you know, decisions, even for product, even for CS, even for the algorithm that fraud teams are using, so that they're all interconnected, but they're pretty siloed today for most businesses out there.
Hmm. It's so fascinating. I just think about like the two friction points, you know, it's like customer experience versus the hard costs of like making a mistake and having your algorithms trip up on each other and creating tickets that people have to go look at. And it's super interesting. So I usually, we're coming to the end here. I usually like to ask people what they think if they have predictions for the future of cybersecurity. But in this particular case, I'm really interested in what you think the future of fraud prevention looks like. Where are we 5-10 years from now?
Yeah, I think today many teams are struggling with the load of the manual work, right? Like still they're spending so much time on investigating transactions and customers. And what they call the rocket science part is making those changes to the algorithm, which then real time, you know, classify those customers or transactions, right? So, you know, we have been shadowing for years our customers, and we have more than 7,000 daily active users on the UI. So we know actually what they spend the most time on. And with this new AI evolution, I think there is an opportunity to elevate the work of those analysts and have them as the designer and supervisor of agents. So I do believe in 3 to 5 years, the manual work they do today could be handled by, you know, to a large extent by AI agents. It doesn't mean their work will go away. It means that, you know, they can be focused on the edge cases instead of finding the edge cases and cutting to the noise. So AI is capable of cutting to the noise, offer them the edge cases, but also the options of the follow-up subsequent steps that they would be advised to take. And then based on certain decisions as part of the evaluation of option A, B, C, or D, which, you know, can be all backed by data, mm-hmm. they can make those calls. Like humans have to set the risk appetite-based direction. They wouldn't have to like spend too much time on that rocket science work of really finding out like how to turn those, you know, fine pot meters right or left way and what impact it might have historically or in the future if we were to simulate the outcomes. In order to elevate this work, I think the software space, including fraud and compliance, is moving into this, you know, what's being called like headless. So I don't think they will spend more and more time on building like dashboards and BI stuff, right? I think they will spend time on building the workflows in a way where the guardrails are in place, the supervision is there, and humans are really utilized to set the direction and then choose from the best options from the business rather than spending 99% of their time of doing this, you know, heavy manual work and then spending time on reports and collecting the metrics and like, you know, managing up instead they would like say like, hey, you know, there's three decisions we could choose from. This is all, you know, generated by AI. You know, I can explain to my peers what are the trade-offs and humans intuitively have this, you know, experience that LLMs won't have of really understanding the context outside of the training data, right? So I think humans will remain essential in that process. But I do see that their work will be totally different, you know, in a couple of years. Selecting those signals that you have to consider and the way how you build the algorithm up to make the assessment at the right time for the right touch points with your customers where risk could be relevant. It's how humans and AI can collaborate together, or like how humans can leverage AI. And there's like, I think, huge room of improvement there in our space, because most of the vendors have only, you know, got started in the last, you know, like 18, 12 months of really like improving on the workflows. But still in the end, the rocket science part is there. Like it hasn't changed. Rocket science part, like changing the algorithm in the right way for the best outcomes, is still the most challenging part of their job, right? So that can be hugely improved by leveraging your LLMs and AI contextually, but still there is, you know, in order to see in our market, in our space, to have a category leader, I think at this point in time, like, you know, really the game is based on who will be the first one who will be able to offer that specific recipe and blueprint to the target buyers out there who might believe that this is the future, right? Like everyone's looking for future-proof solutions. Everyone is working under the leadership directive of, you know, spending more on tokens instead of more of third-party softwares, right? So combining this, all, you know, all these elements and puzzle pieces into a mix, I believe that, you know, humans can remain strategic in decision-making process, but AI can, you know, with the help of a system of a record, can truly guide those decisions to have the best outcomes.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. It's been a really interesting conversation. I'm definitely fascinated by fraud prevention now, and I'm going to be doing some research after the call.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Chris, as well. We appreciate the chance.
All right. Take care, sir.
Yeah, thanks.
And that brings us to the end of another great conversation. You can support our show by sharing your favorite episode with a friend, subscribe, give us a rating, or leave a comment on your favorite podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake, with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.